Okay, this is Rachel Seidman, and I'm here in Brooklyn with Joanne Smith at Girls for Gender Equity, and we are undertaking an oral history for a project called Speaking Up, Speaking Out, Talking Back, an Oral History of Feminism in the Digital Age. Joanne, I'm going to ask you to start by helping to situate me with your background. Can you tell me about your grandparents and what you, do you know them? Did you grow up with them? Where were they from?
Sure. So my grandparents are, and I'm talking about my maternal grandparents, are Haitians who grew up and lived in Haiti most of their lives. My grandmother, actually, Ninive Leger, is the woman my middle name.
Can you spell her name for me?
N-I-N-I-V-E.
Okay.
Was a real matriarch of the family. So, you know, in Haiti, she was, I guess, a powerful woman, a woman who, you know, she had five kids and took care of the family with my grandfather, who was an engineer, and he was, I guess, well-respected in Haiti, and, you know, they had property and space, and then he really... I guess had trouble during the Papa Doc regime, and had trouble getting or keeping a job. My grandmother, this is the story my mother tells us, my grandmother wrote to Kennedy at the time, and Kennedy answered back her letter, and she wrote to him asking if he could help my grandfather to really secure an engineering job, and he did in Tunisia.
Wow. Not what she had in mind.
Not what she was saying. Yeah, so he did in Tunisia. He secured an opportunity for him, and he went to Tunisia, and ultimately that was their marital demise.
Oh.
Yeah. So my grandmother actually moved to New York 7 years before sending for her children, and really, you know, establish herself, bought a house in Queens, and then...
How was she supporting herself?
Working as a nurse, working, doing, you know, whatever jobs that she could, and her degree didn't hold in New York what it held in Haiti, so she would have to work, I think, several jobs. Her closest friend, Tete Lamont, Teresa Lamont, took care of then the kids at the house and helped to raise then my mother and my aunts and uncles, and had also her own business. My mother tells me, without labeling themselves as feminists, these were the real feminists of the family, who really, you know, did what it took to take care of the family, but also were innovative and leaders and entrepreneurs, and you know, really as a community saw it as normal, as women saw it as normal as taking lead and doing what it takes to take care of the family. And so my grandmother sent for all of them, and they all came then to New York City. So
all at the same time.
All at the same time. So when I think of my grandparents, my maternal grandparents, I think of I have happy thoughts of them. I have thoughts of them, you know, being real pioneers, and understanding that they've also made great sacrifices for us to be here. And in particular, my grandmother. I think of them sometimes a little bit as martyrs, in the sense of sacrificing wealth and property to come here and have to work so hard and then also sacrificing the children and the lives and the time away in the relationship in that way. And so for my grandmother, who has passed away, the time with her as a child was endearing, and I remember combing her hair and dyeing her hair and braiding it, and you know, the candies at the bottom of the purse that have a little bit of crumbs on them. And I remember her loving us very deeply, but I remember her as a, you know, older woman who, or an old woman, I would say, who, you know, really sacrificed a lot. And I think by the time she, you know, reached, you know, her 80s, may have been really sad about that and what she has missed. So for me, it has helped shape not being a martyr and saying, you know, I am no martyr, because I feel like I've witnessed what that sacrifice means, and it means yourself in a way that I don't even think I have, right? So I don't think I was born with that martyrdom in that kind of a way.
How do you think it affected your mom? How old was your mom when she came?
So my mom was 13 when she came, and it was, you know, during adolescence, being 13, it was really traumatic because she didn't speak the language. She had, of course, four siblings, so I have two uncles and two aunts, and my mother had, at the time, like, long hair, so my grandmother, both my grandmother and grandfather, Haitian, and of course everybody's mixed with Indian, and for them it was a little more transparent, and so her hair was, all the aunts and uncles' hair was really long and you know, black, and my mother got you know, I guess attacked a lot within the community. So they moved two places, Queens, and then also lived on 108th and Broadway. I still remember the address, 255 108th and Broadway. And that's where many of us then, like, grew up and came through. And many times on the way to school, it was very Dominican community, and at that time, and many times on the way to school, then she would be attacked or assaulted, or and most of it was because she didn't understand the language, so she didn't answer people. And then they would pull her hair, and then, you know, they would fight. And so a lot of the shaping around dealing with, I guess, conflict is you fight back, you know. And then also, I think for her, assimilating into a culture where, I guess, where she's seen as black, but her history and her, you know, cultural values and practices and behaviors, you know, were reared in Haiti, where very much, you know, is shaped by colorism and internalized racism, but at the same time, throughout every socioeconomic status and rights, it, black people are the ones determining that. And so it was an assimilation into understanding how she's seen and having to deal with how she's seen, but not feeling like an African-American who has grown up in the U.S. And this is something we still have conversations around, because, you know, she just although now she has the experiences and can understand and connect the experiences as being seen as an African-American who's grown up in the U.S., she still very much has a strong connection to what it means to be Haitian and growing up in Haiti, and in the island where she felt at the time had many resources and great memories and great privilege and great emphasis on academics and education, and how that helped to shape her and her value set, as well as rituals and, mm-hmm. and behavior. So she's very much in the Haitian community in Miami and in New York, and with a strong accent. She won't let it go, even though now she's 66, and you know, it's one of the things I very much love about her, and is very connected to Haitian culture. So she said it wasn't until her 30s that she realized, oh, okay, I am seen as, you know, an African-American here, and this is what racism here feels like and looks like, because she was very much entrenched in Haitian culture here.
So what would you say were the lessons or the values that she articulated to you that grew out of those experiences?
A very strong sense of fighting. I have memories from second grade, coming home and telling her how a boy kicked me when I wanted to play soccer, and he kicked me in my shin, and I cried and went and sat down, and I told a teacher, and the teacher told me sit down, and I sat down, and she was like, what'd you do next? And you know, I was like, well, then we had to go. And she was like, you tomorrow go and you play soccer, and if he kicks you, you kick him back. And she's like, and just don't let him kick you. Right? So I did, and I went, and before he could kick me, I kicked him, and he cried. And the difference was both of us now had to sit down, right? But then the third day I went back, and I came back, and I told her I didn't. She was like, okay, good. And did you play soccer? No. Okay, well, you know, play soccer if you want to play soccer. And the next day I went and I played soccer, and he picked me for his team. So to fight, that memory really has been at the core of a lot of things that I have done, where, you know, obviously I don't kick people anymore, but definitely understand that, basically, as Asada says, it's our duty to fight, right? And that you can't allow yourself to be really, I mean, not just kick, but you can't allow people to determine what it is that you are going to do if you are determined to do it. And she showed me that through getting her degree at 50. So I'm one of three girls. I'm the youngest of three. In raising us, and she had my sister, her first daughter, at 20. And in raising us, you know, many times she would little by little go to school and get credits and then lose credits and, you know, work so hard to raise us. I would see her falling asleep at the dining room table as she's, you know, preparing for the next class. And by 50 years old, she finally got her bachelor's degree and walked across the stage. And it was one of the proudest moments to see that, you know, determination was. Many times when people would have already given in and just focused on their career, that she really was determined to get her degree, and that she wasn't going to allow all of the setbacks to deter that. So she taught me that, but also taught me, she also taught me to really hold on to my value set when it comes to family, right? So in the family, there are no throwaways, right? As much as we argue or fight or whatever obstacles there are, there's always a way back in. There's always a way, like nobody's exiled from the family, regardless of what they have done. And I think right now, especially my mother being one of the matriarchs of the family, that value set is something that she still carries and is at the core of then how now intergenerationally siblings, aunts, cousins, uncles then interact with each other, right? So regardless if I don't remember aunts who remember me at 3 months old and tell me, no, you gotta remember me, you held my finger. My mother has me at their house regardless when I'm in, you know, Florida with her. Regardless if haven't spoken to cousins in 10 years and didn't even know they were our cousins, you know, this is family and this is, you know, where you come from and who you are, and this is the memory of that you all share together. And so give him a kiss, right? And I think that that's very much shaped how then I do the work here and we do the work here, where there are no throwaways, right? You come into the work and supporting and elevating and leading the way for girls and women of color. And regardless of where you are, we will meet you there. And you have something to offer. So many times you hear it in things like when we talk about our Urban Leaders Academy after school program for middle school students, where we say you could be a leader for a moment in a decision. You could be a leader for a day or a lifetime. I mean, that leadership comes in many forms and it matters. And even thinking of now within this movement or moment, right, of Black Lives Matter and really, you know, the racial justice fight of the 21st century. Everybody doesn't have to be on the front lines and marching, right? Everybody has a role and everybody's needed. And so I feel like those values were really shaped by my upbringing, my mother's core values, as well as what we've seen from our grandparents and the path it took to get here. Mm-hmm. And the shoulders that I stand on to even get here. Mm-hmm. We would have never, you know, thought, or I would have never thought that seeing my mother fall asleep, you know, at the table to get that one other credit, right, mattered so much until then I saw the culmination and then her graduating. And it for me summarized that, wow, it all that hard work paid off, and that's what it took for her, and it's my clearly not what it takes for everybody, but what it took for her got her, and she was willing to do the work, and it got her where she needed to be. So it was then worth it.
What you've talked a lot about your mom. What role did your dad play in shaping you?
So my dad, very early on in my life, my mom and dad divorced. So my sisters are 7 and 5 years older than me. So my father was very instrumental in being their caregiver when my mom and him were married. And I think I was the surprise child, the let's give it one more go child. So of course, then that brings on the third stress, right, of the family. So for my mom and dad, probably around 3, 4, my mother left New York, left my sisters here to, and brought me with her. Actually, it was around 4 or 5. Brought me with her to Virginia to look for a new, not just new life, but career and ways in which she can raise us, because she knew living in New York, in Queens, they owned a home, they were divorcing, and she wasn't going to be able to afford to live here. And her brother, who's the oldest, lived in Virginia. And so she moved to Virginia to relocate and to, you know, find a new career. And she always done accounting work. So she ended up landing a job at IBM and moved us all then to Virginia. And then, so with my father, he was very much her friend, but he wasn't in our lives as a consistent father. It wasn't until 22 when my sister's daughter, Alexis, was going through her first communion. I was 22 and she was, I guess, 7, going through her first communion, and asked, because her father and paternal grandparents were always around, mm-hmm. and asked, well, where's your father, Mom? And, you know, as we're making this guest list, he needs to be here, right? And it really sparked from my sister the fact that she wants them to really be in each other's lives. And she reached out. And, you know, as the oldest sister, it was very brave. And she really opened up the door for all of us as sisters to heal and embrace my father back into the family. And it really was up to us. We didn't know that, right? To be able to do that, because I think for him, or I know for him, it was great shame that he wasn't able to be the father that he knew we needed, and that he let us down. And he very much felt that way and didn't know how to reconcile that. And felt like he couldn't do anything really about that. Mm-hmm. So after great strides of writing letters back and forth, talking back and forth, he definitely came to the First Communion, and then since then has been in our lives. As a matter of fact, as we do this interview, he's in Maryland now with the family and the grandkids and everyone, because he is now, you know, back and has been for the last 10 years, 12 years, actually the last 18 years, part of our lives in an instrumental way.
So, you grew up in Virginia then?
So then I grew up in Maryland,
Okay. And so tell me about, I know about the little girl, you kicking the boy on the soccer
team. I had to.
tell me about you in high school. Looking back, how would you describe yourself in high school?
I sometimes feel guilty I had a great high school experience, because it means that then I'm sure I contributed to people not having a great high school experience, because high school is so difficult for so many. And so in high school, I think I was very athletic in high school, or very much connected with athletics. I played soccer, I played basketball, and I ran cross country. And this was in Montgomery County. I went to Seneca Valley High School. And so for me, I always had team, and I always had a leadership position. I was in varsity in ninth grade, so from the time that I came into high school, then I was in a space where, because we played sports, then we would be seen and folks would know us who we probably didn't know. I did struggle a lot in high school when it came to, being disciplined, or being, or following, I guess, rules that I didn't think made sense. I thought high school was a place in Montgomery County. I've just gained language around my experience in high school through the work that has happened here at GGE, and understanding school pushout, implicit bias, and understanding, you know, how I was seen and the role, the gender role I should have been playing, and always going against that grain. So for me, high school was a place where, while I felt free, as I reflect back on it, I realize the limitations and expectations that were kind of put on me. So what does that mean? In high school, for instance, I had shop class, cooking class, I learned to type, I learned to drive, right? All of the perks that came with living in one of the richest counties on the East Coast, and that was, at that time, Montgomery County. After school programming, classroom size, like the antithesis of New York City, because you just had an abundance of everything, and you thought that's how it was supposed to be. At 16, you're supposed to get a car. At, you know, space, house-wise, you have it. Field space, you have it. You don't even have to be part of a team, and you can stay in an after-school environment. And so for me, as someone who at the time had so much energy and, you know, enjoyed sports so much, it was the ideal place to be. I did well in school because I was creative, but when I look back at like my grades and really the cornerstones of learning and development, I do feel like I got passes because I was creative, because I was the only Black one maybe in that AP English class, and what I was bringing or what I was offering was unique. And you know, I remember a white girl in high school saying, "Wow, you're articulate," in AP English class. And I remember then another white girl, actually, Melissa Gibson, saying, "She's in AP English with us. That is a racist comment to make," right? And it was, for me, a moment of like, yeah, that's right, right? And it was the first time somebody came to my defense in that way, where that kind of, you know, those kind of microaggressions and you know, that kind of bias was so overt that she called it out. But usually it's one of the things that people feel like, well, I don't see the problem in saying that. It's a compliment. And so high school is where I was able to, you know, explore who I was. It's where I realized that, you know, I was a lesbian and I wasn't yet naming myself as a lesbian. It was where I decided I'll have agency on my body and, you know, what I would and wouldn't do. But a lot of that freedom came from playing sports. And so sports really shaped then how I saw myself in the community and in community with people as a team, and how I saw reaching goals, how I saw handling setbacks. And it's what got me to college on a scholarship. And so how I saw handling, you know, debt that I essentially didn't have to have because I was able to, you know, get this kind of a scholarship. And that very much, those perks very much mattered every step of the way for us in a way that I didn't realize until I looked back because of the socioeconomic status we were in. It was single mom, three kids. I'm, you know, the last one off, and she's working, you know, at IBM as an accountant to really make ends meet. And, you know, while her salary was good and fine, it wasn't, we weren't at a level where we were going to be able to, you know, we weren't rich. We weren't going to be able to have all of the perks that we wanted. And so thinking about where you know, things were going to come from, college tuition was going to come from, and computers were going to come from, was real. Payment plans were real. And it was understanding that, wow, I was really blessed and fortunate to be in that community, even if it wasn't set up for me. I benefited from it, and it helped to determine my economic outcome leaving then college. And so then it made like that high school experience, all those hours of practicing, all those hours of, you know, walking the line, really worth it, because of that.
It's an interesting echo, the way you describe that, of seeing your mom work so hard at the coursework.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it pays off.
Yeah.
Hard work pays off.
Yeah.
Okay, so which sport got you to...
Basketball.
Basketball. And you went to college?
I went to Bowie State University.
Okay.
In Maryland.
Yeah.
HBCU. So, and that was to really try to center myself around Black culture and to really feel more of a connection.
Mm-hmm.
Because I grew up in Montgomery County and in the suburbs, and felt like that was really missing.
And did it give you what you wanted?
Not fully.
Not
fully. I think, again, Bowie State University was a good experience. I met lifelong friends, but it wasn't the robust experience that I then had at Louisiana State University when I went into the pre-doctoral academy, because that experience came with also seeing every socioeconomic class, but also seeing another level of academic achievement and excellence, another level of a Doric understanding and cultural competence within coursework that really, once you know I completed that, shaped the reality that, wow, I really can do anything that I apply myself to, because I see these great examples of people who have, and a great willingness of them to mentor me, mm-hmm. and to really open doors and create pathways. And it's a matter of then how I show up. But then the resources and the wealth of knowledge is here. So even something as robust as their library, their facilities, the way in which they had a level of expectation on the coursework and what it was that we were going to turn in, and being sure that that was not just academically rigorous, but full of integrity and in line with your moral value set. And it was a program, Kofi Lomote led the program, but it in...
What kind of program?
It was called the Nubian Predoctoral Academy, and it was a program to help shape research and PhDs if you were interested in moving on to that kind of or that level of scholarship.
And how long were you at Louisiana State?
And I was in the program for 2 months.
Oh, okay.
It was just a program, post bachelor's level program.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I came from Bowie and mm-hmm. got that, and that like was something I very much needed, and then made me realize, wow, what I missed. So I didn't know what I missed at Bowie, and a lot of that, when I say like what I missed at Bowie, you gotta remember I was a scholar athlete, and so much of the time was spent in the gym and on the road and then in homework help, and we did things together as a team, as opposed to having then that space to explore and seek the mentorship. And our coach at the time, for me, just wasn't the coach that I needed as a young woman who was coming to terms with her identity, a young woman who was used to a certain level of care from coaches and expectation of academic scholarship. Like, I was the only one to graduate in 4 years on the team, which was kind of very sad. So academics didn't come first on the team. And it was also a coach who was very, you know, patriarchal, and it wasn't going to work for me because I didn't grow up in that setting. I grew up in a setting where I had a voice, and if I had to fight for the voice, then it was going to be still heard, and it had value. It didn't, value maybe was based on hierarchical, but not off of me being, you know, a woman. And he was very much a dad figure to many of the young women there, which worked for them, but it didn't work for me. I needed, if you were going to be that, more support, understanding, I needed conversation, not dictatorship and it coming down to, well, I'm the coach, because that just wasn't going to ever work. Bowie was fun, though. Bowie was fun. Bowie shaped, the experience there shaped some of my feminist value around sexuality and sexual orientation. It was very, again, in D.C., based on being a lesbian or being LGBT was very much based on a heteronormative model, and was consistently like, you're either feminine or you're either masculine, and you look that way and you act that way and you emulate what masculinity, you know, is for men, and you're either feminine and very jazzed up, and you know, I'm neither of those things. There's some things about me that are very feminine, and some things about me that are determined as masculine, and some things that just work for everybody, right? And so it was a space where I realized, wow, like, this isn't gonna really work, and this further reinforces that I need to be in New York, because I've always felt like, well, I'm a New Yorker. We've always come back and forth a few times a year to New York, and it's just always felt like home and where I'm supposed to be compared to Maryland. Mm-hmm. So
after your 2 months at Louisiana State, mm-hmm. I do want to get to here. It sounds like that was, though, a pretty eye-opening, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but maybe transformative moment for
Absolutely.
You. So can you talk about the what you did with that realization after that?
Sure. I came to New York after that, and I wasn't clear on the path still I wanted to take. So I didn't go to master's right away. I worked here at the Brooklyn AIDS Task Force, and before that I worked at Reedland Children and Families, which is now Harlem Children's Zone in Harlem. And I really explored for myself what it means to do social work service, and because I graduated with a psychology degree, and I realized my path was to be a psychiatrist, and I realized I did not want to be a psychiatrist.
Why not?
I didn't personally believe that would be my best path going on to medical school and diagnosing people. I thought that my value was counseling. My value was I guess now social work, and realizing that at the core it was, you know, caretaking and creating an environment and situation where there are options. Like, it just, psychiatry didn't fit what I thought it was supposed to fit and how it was supposed to support. And so that's why I said, well, let me take a step back and really determine where it is that I need to be, because I explored art therapy, I explored industrial psychology, right? And there was also an entrepreneurial spirit about me. I also wanted to be rich. I thought, you know, I have to also be wealthy within this work. I can't, family-wise, that was a value set. Like, you need to gain, and my mother was an accountant, you need to gain wealth, you need to have savings, you need to, you know, manage your economics. And so when I came to New York, then I started working, and I knew I loved children. Everybody knew that, and I would create in those spaces, even if it wasn't there, spaces for young people to build, to lend their voice, to share, because many times the focus was on the parents, and the young people were considered collaterals. Mm-hmm. And so it was through the experience as case manager or case supervisor that I realized that, one, the bureaucracy of New York was something I couldn't understand, right? So when the families were getting entitlements in one place, the other place, you know, had no connection to it. Schools and institutions were just so disjointed and disconnected, and that it felt like a hamster wheel, like we're doing assessments and reassessments, and I didn't want to be part of that kind of bureaucracy. But it also opened up the opportunity, because those groups that I would start would be voluntary groups and voluntary work. It wasn't work I was getting paid for, and it opened up the opportunity to build my skills working with young people. And so the opportunity came to apply for a fellowship through Open Society Foundation, and I applied for Girls for Gender Equity in Sports. Mm-hmm. And really looked at taking my experience as an athlete and creating space for girls of color to be to play, but also to be seen differently in the community. Because what I observed, and it became really clear right away, was that had I grown up in New York, the opportunities and the path that I just went on would have been so much different. Mm-hmm. It would have been different because of the lack of opportunities and expectation of girls to play sports. Just now and this year, National Women's Law Center has a lawsuit against New York City high schools because of their lack of implementation around Title IX in sports. And so sports were so important to me in high school that if I didn't have them, that kind of energy and angst and anger around my father, anger around, you know, whatever was going on in school would have been taken out, you know, somewhere else in the streets, possibly, depending on where we lived. It could have been in gangs. It could have been looking for support other places. It could have been in relationships and having, you know, early pregnancy. Who knows, right? I am not different than, you know, the other girls. It's just a matter of what conditions are created for me to thrive. So I felt like it was very clear that what I needed to do was create better conditions, because the freedom I thought I had in high school, in college, at LSU, and then coming to New York, wasn't real freedom until I knew others were free, and that our destiny was really tied, and that I had to do something different and couldn't just be part of the everyday business as usual and maintaining this systemic oppression. Mm-hmm. And so this opportunity for the fellowship was that, without even the realization that we'd be here today. It was really like in the moment and thinking of it as 18-month fellowship, and here's what I can create. Let's try it. Why not? And going for it, you know, going forward with it. Mm-hmm. And it really evolving and into something I would have never imagined. Mm-hmm. Had I not this opportunity. So the fellowship really changed the trajectory of my life and many other lives, and what has us here today.
So it's a really interesting example. I'm trying to think how to articulate this, but I'm thinking about the connection between legal change and social or cultural change, right? Title IX,
mm-hmm,
got passed and made a huge impact.
Absolutely.
On your life.
And Title IX was researched in Montgomery County, and that was the first place that it was researched, which was why I had such access to so much as a young woman.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't apply evenly.
Nope.
Right. So can you reflect on that? I mean, you must have thought about this a lot.
Absolutely. I mean, that was one of the first... Title IX has been our umbrella policy starting as Girls for Gender Equity in Sports. It was 2005 we changed the name to Girls for Gender Equity, in understanding that just like many things even now, philanthropy and people are often trying to catch up to organizations and revolutionary work, right? And so in Girls for Gender Equity in Sports, it was about revolutionizing again the way that girls of color see themselves. So even starting from a micro level and understanding their physical capacity and agency, and also being healthy and enjoying sports and having opportunities. But then on a macro level, organizing, right, and bringing community together. And we center, especially New York City is a basketball city, so we center a lot of our activities around sports. And when you have young people or children within that, that's when the parents come, that's when the teachers come, that's when the community comes, and it's a then way to organize, right, and to bring about change. And so especially with that being the framework, we tapped into the Women's Sports Foundation and really learning more and using what we learned around how then Black girls in particular and Latino girls don't then have the access, and the cultural competence around sports looks so different, right? So we talk about not wanting our hair to sweat out, and what that means to, you know, be in gym class and be sweaty and then have to go on, and how then the community responds to that, and how we you know, as coaches, mentors, as teachers, create the conditions for that to not be the main value set, and how much then work we have to do on ourselves, because that's our value set, right? So when you see you know, a child even now, right, think about Blue Ivy and a black woman starting a petition around Beyonce combing her hair as a 2-year-old baby. It just demonstrates how much we are for the pickings, right? Not just for systemically and institutionally, but even within our own communities, right? We are vulnerable. We are accessible. We are, able to be like, that's actually okay. Over, I think, 5,000 people signed this petition, and it doesn't matter socioeconomic wise. It's Beyonce and Jay-Z, right? And it doesn't matter. They're still touchable in that way. And so this is, obviously very deep, cultural, and we're just talking about hair, right? But it's a very deep, culturally embedded value that, here's a space where we can have a conversation about it and have a conversation about what that means and what does it say when you see your daughter coming home and her hair is, up in the air because she was sweating. And it says, I don't know how to take care of her. It says, I'm poor. It says, she doesn't care about what she looks like. And, it reflects then on the family in that kind of a way. You wouldn't think that, sitting on a floor in a basketball court, with families around, that kind of, conversation would evoke tears and then a new understanding of, why then it's so important for you to say, it's okay. You're still beautiful. It also evokes, right, that she has bad hair, she's not beautiful and she's not going to then have chances at A, B, and C. And the child is in fifth grade, right? And so, her also sweating out the perm means now that I have to pay more money, right, for her to go and get her hair done again. This is just one little conversation. So through understanding how Title IX misses so many of us, and I guess starting from a real grounding space of who are you walking in this space? Who are you leaving this space? Who are the people around you? The whole ecological framework of who are holding you, who's the community, how does this policy impact you and change your life that we're here celebrating as women? Is it for all women? And what advances have you seen? And how has it created those opportunities for you? Is how then we would talk about Title IX, is how we would look at Title IX, and then how we would use opportunities to bring a more cultural lens to Title IX implementation within the schools, because we all understood it wasn't just about creating opportunities in sports. The other piece is around sexual harassment, especially, and that's where we really went deep, because, again, for our girls, what came up was on the court them being for the picking. So something as simple as having 7 to 12 year olds play, but having boys in the gym at 10, 11, they're already, many of them look, if you didn't see their face physically, like women, right? They're already hit puberty, and size wise, we're bigger than what you thought their age was big, say big for your age, right? And so running up and down the court, it took a little girl to tell me why she didn't change. I knew she loved it. I knew she loved to play. I knew she had fun. It was instructional. It wasn't so competitive. It took her to tell me, I'm just not comfortable. And so then, seeing how she was holding her chest, understanding she needs a sports bra. Mm-hmm. And so getting her sports bras, and then her being like, oh, this is better. But then still being like, I'm just not comfortable, right? And then finally sitting down and saying, what's going on? She was like, and then seeing where her eyes looked, and it's like boys in the corner, like talking about her, pointing about her, that they're always, following me out after, or they, say something that when I go over there to get the balls, I don't even want to go get the ball. And then realizing, wow, it creating the conditions, you also need to create the environment and the education, and there's accountability there, and connecting that to Title IX in schools, trying to identify the Title IX coordinators in schools so that those kind of conditions can be created, that kind of education can happen. We would do workshops and trainings for the physical fitness teachers during, I guess, during citywide trainings where they would all come in and, and try to apply this cultural lens. But it was really challenging work, and especially around Title IX, identifying, who would then be accountable for creating those kind of conditions in the most basic form, and then actually with some nuance to it that would really dig deep. Mm-hmm. So I know you asked about Title IX, and I probably went all around the way, but...
I'm interested in the changing context in which all these organizations are working and how that shapes the work you do. So, for instance, I forget what year Girls for Gender Equity and Sports was started.
Well, the fellowship started September 11th, 2001. And then we were incorporated June 2002.
September 11th, 2001.
Mm-hmm, that was the first day of the fellowship.
So that must have had an impact on how you were thinking about your work.
It had a deep impact because I was also in social work school. Mm-hmm. So I got accepted to Master's Social Work School at Hunter. At the same time, I got the fellowship. So it was beautiful for me. That being said, September 11th happened. It was the first day of gathering. We were at the Bed-Stuy YMCA, and it was, that morning, it was, do I still go? I went, and we were working with 7 to 12-year-old girls from the community, and the deal with the Bed-Stuy Y at that time was at 12, girls drop out of the Y, right? So usually their parents have them, enroll, and then they come here after school, but like we lose them. And so if you can increase enrollment of girls from the community, you can be your fiscal sponsor. And so it was a way to increase their enrollment, but also they had two gyms at the time. This was before they had the school. And so when set up, girls came. And it was the reality, it was stark reality that what was happening over the bridge did not affect their lives. It was their parents weren't working over the bridge. The school kept the TVs off. Many TVs didn't even work. So they didn't know what had happened. They didn't see it. They were just here, living their day to day, and they were here in the gym. And I've seen that consistently as movements have been happening, international tragedies happen, Bring Back Our Girls. I mean, it's such a disconnect from what's happening in the real world.
So I wanted to ask you, because that raises this other question I realize I've read stuff you've written about that moment, but that question, in North Carolina, we talk a lot about the digital divide, mm-hmm. because there's such a large rural community, and that's where it's most noticeable. But it sounds like you're seeing that also here strongly in that community. Is that fair to say?
I think at that time, so we're talking about 2001, 2002, so the access to smartphones and the digital access was different. The news sources, right? So where they get their news and how it is they see their world affected is still a divide.
Here now,
yeah. Right? So even when I think about, I had a meeting with feminists, black feminists, writers and scholars, as well as folks who are social media gurus in Black Twitter, and so many of our girls, right, the girls that, you know, they are then speaking for and speaking about and creating pathways for and doing revolutionary work around, wouldn't know them if they fell on them, because they wouldn't even understand the language that's being used, because it's not the day-to-day on-the-ground language that's being used. So that, even, you know, intra-community is such a divide. Yeah, and when I say girls, I'm talking about under 18 year old girls.
So what did you tell the journalists? You said you had this meeting.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So I told them that, right? And I told them that it's in partnership, because part of, I guess, that meeting itself was around, you know, black feminism work happening. And part of what I was feeling within that meeting was a devalue of the nonprofit industrial complex and how we hold community, and maybe that might have just been my own, you know, defense of being in that space and feeling like, okay, we have to bring it together, right? So we have to come together with it. So there needs to be robust academia and scholarship. There needs to be robust, direct service and organizing that's on the ground and with the young people, and there needs to be robust social media and voices, and that we need to connect them, and that work to connect them has to happen, should be funded, and has to happen intentionally. It's not just coming together, and for them to know that, right? No matter if you have 50,000 followers, right? Your 50,000 followers or likely not the ones most affected, or the ones coming up, you know, from 7 to 18 years old as young people in the community. They are the ones who, you know, are well-read, had a good mentor who, you know, connected them, or came upon feminism and black feminism through school, or, you know, had access in a way that these young people on a day-to-day do not seek and wouldn't know to connect with unless they're directed that way, and would need to be reached, and that would take work, you know, coming from them, because what they're offering is not just revolutionary but necessary and innovative, right? And that digital divide is so real, but it's not just about the digital divide being about coding and being about how to get a job within, you know, technology. It's also about being able to communicate and translate ideas and connect to ideas in really innovative way, and owning your voice and cultivating a skill set around scholarship and mastery that you can own and be proud of, right? Because what many young people are not realizing is you know, their digital footprint being so, being one, something they've been born into, right? And something that doesn't then go away. And that it has to be crafted, and it has to be very thoughtful, and that we need help with that here, right? Not just at GGE, but within nonprofits and community-based organizations, help with learning that, and that we have, you know, a lot to offer and hold for young people. So basically that we're all valuable, and we have to be able to come together, and how can we think through coming together and doing this work together.
Do you have a vision for what that partnership would look like?
You know, I think big tent, right? And so when I think about GGE, I think about, you know, having those kind of scholars here, right? I think of them actually being part of the work, part of the curriculum, part of the day-to-day, not just an event or a conference. I mean, that's what we end up settling for. But part of the growing edge of figuring it out together, right? And also being informed by the girls as we do it, and the young people as we do it, So, for instance, the vision for that within Urban Leaders Academy has been young people, or I should say the practice of that in Urban Leaders Academy has been young people, you know, learning to develop websites and blogs and storytelling and doing so, you know, in-house in an after-school environment, connecting internationally with other youth organizers who are, in Mexico or in Brazil, who are, fighting against oppression and sharing stories in that way via Skype and getting a sense of that, but wanting to also have the actual practice of exploring, examining, talking about, having classes around, Twitter, having classes around social media, not in the just this is what you don't do, but here are the possibilities, right? Let's go deeper in what it is they're saying, right? In 140 characters, what it is they're saying with this point here, how it is that your, content can help shape dialogue. What feedback do you have or comment do you have? And so like being able to reply back and feel confident in then that reply, being able to do also the research and not just the instant Wikipedia, right? The research around developing your own point and critique and developing your critical thinking skills and comparing that and doing it at a really early age with the expectation that even though you're not in college yet and your frontal lobe isn't fully developed, you can do it, right? You have something to say and it matters. Your viewpoint from this age in middle school really matters and can add to the conversation. And the conversation online and it not be a separate conversation of this is a space for middle school students, but that on this, conversation around Charleston, I have something to say about the Charleston 9 and the shooter, and I understand what is happening within, North Carolina because I can connect, historically what has happened, but also I can connect Eric Garner and understand what has happened there and how it has impacted us here. And not having, again, to be re-traumatized or to be traumatized, but to be able to make those connections and see themselves in the story. So I see a vision of us being able to come together and do the work in that way, but there are no shortcuts. It's really about, to me anyway, it's really about creating programming, creating opportunities that are not just one-off, that are consistently embedded within the work that we do with young people and expectations that we have, as well as the teaching that has to happen. It's reciprocal. There's a reciprocity around learning from young people, because we all think many times that, oh, we know what they're going through, but no, we were not born in an age where technology and Google or Facebook was your first email, right? It's just, but for them, even practices like Word or Outlook, they just don't know. They don't know what a busy signal sounds like, right? That's just not what they grew up with, and to them it's amazing when they can hear it. So to be able to appreciate the instant information that they're getting, how they're processing it and how they're experiencing it, to be able to learn from that and appreciate that without it being a case study, with it actually being a praxis in life, is my ultimate vision for how we tie in all those different mediums.
The other thing about these very young girls that you work with is that for many of them, they barely remember a time when the president was not a black man.
That's right.
How do you see that affecting their sense of citizenship, their role in the country, or anything else?
I think it's a matter of, us shaping it, because while they have seen the president and know the president to be a black man, many will say, well, now you know you can do anything, right? And it's the reality that, you know, he's an outlier. He's a genius. He is, has worked for that. He was reared for that, in ways that, you know, he might have overcome many obstacles to be able to get there, but it's not something everybody has, black, white, whatever. Like, no, it doesn't mean that. Like, actually, you could be 8, and you might have passed the age that you could be president because you haven't done the work that it takes to, you know, have that then capacity. It's the reality, or you won't have the resources that it will take to get you to that Ivy League school, and that's the reality. So for me, I think that's a really great question, and for me, I worry a little about that being the theme, like, because it's a black president, anybody could be president, you know, and I worry about it because of how much I realized, you know, as and still realize as I do the work, like, oh, wow, I thought once I got here, that would mean this happens. I mean, you know, things open up, floodgates happen, or by 28, I was supposed to be rich, you know, or, you know, once I got that degree, it was supposed to get easier, and I was supposed to be able to move mountains, right? And the reality of the instant gratification and understanding millennials and trying to understand millennials more and trying to understand what really gets them going and makes them tick and helps them to stay committed to long-term, lifelong social change. So for me, knowing at 26, after, you know, great tragedy in the program and assaults and threats within the program on my life, realizing, okay, I have to make a decision if I'm willing to die for this. I have to make a decision if this is lifelong work for me. And deciding that, right? And worrying if those kind of decisions would be made by these young people. If anything would drive them to that, because they see the world as just, you know, great possibilities of them being able to do anything, or if they can see that they have to stick to, you know, paths. I don't think it's either or. I think it's a matter of me feeling like, you know, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how that will shape them and ultimately what great accomplishments will happen and or disappointments will happen. And so it's to be seen. And I only say that because much of the optimism is around, yes, I can do anything because this is the president. And what hasn't happened yet is then what will happen post black president, and how that would then shape their thinking around what it is that they can do. While at my age, I feel like I will never again in my lifetime see a black president. Nevertheless, a black woman president. I don't even know who's in line for a black woman president within my lifetime, because that's how far away I feel from the presidency as a black woman. Not personally, but in the status, right? Yeah, so I don't know. I'm sure we'll see it play out. I wish I had the answer to that, but I don't know.
So I have to, because you raised it, I have to go back and ask you about the threats and what on you.
Sure.
And to tell that story and what went through your mind or what you feel like compels your commitment after that.
Well, so there was an incident in the programming where there was a 12-year-old girl and her sister was 7 or 8, and her job that day in the program was for the 7 to 8 year olds, but this 12-year-old girl was a great basketball player and loved it. She reminded me of myself. She just was committed. She was going to keep trying, and she was very athletic. She was really, you know, a good athlete, and she went on to do play really well in school. But her job that day was to pick up her little sister at school, and she did it. She just came straight to the program. When students didn't go, or when participants didn't come to the program, it wasn't something where we would call home and find out what happened to them. You know, who came we would work with, and who didn't, and we would hope they would come back, you know, the next time. There was a game, and there was, you know, a lot of young people there, and schools would come in and would play like tournaments or what have you. So what happened was, then as people were leaving, then I got the frantic, at the time we had beepers and, you know, I think flip phones, and got the frantic, had the frantic call that she didn't pick up her sister from school, and that's because she ended up going home, and her mom was like, she didn't pick up her sister, and then they went to the school, and they couldn't find her sister, and that her sister was missing. And so I got it from the front desk, that these parents were up here, and they were looking for me, because her sister was missing, and then got the parents, you know, as we were, like, ushering people off, the parents came back, and they had been drinking, and they were looking, you know, still for her, and they, you know, threatened me and said, if we don't find her, right, like, if we don't find our daughter, like, we're going to come back and kill you, like, she better, you know, come up. And me trying to explain, like, that's not on me, and asking what, and trying to understand what happened, because I didn't know at the time her sister was supposed to pick her up, and she was running her programming, and what have you. So try to understand that. At the same time, they're frantic. So they go off, and then, you know, I stay and finish out with the students, and then they ended up finding her at the police station. And that's what happens. The school brings them to the police station if they're left. And so they come back, and they're like, you know, you're lucky, you know, and you know, still, we won't, basically kick ass, like, you're lucky we found her and what have you, just come outside, you know. And me being at the front desk, and the front desk being like, do you want to call the police, like, we're going to call the police if they don't leave, like, you know, they've been known to, in the community, and they're from the community, and they've been known in the community to, you know, fight, they're drunk, and, you know, I wouldn't go out there with you, basically. And me in that moment, like, I probably didn't make the best decision in talking back to them and saying, because I wanted to understand, one, what happened, and then two, I wanted to understand, what the hell were you? Like, where were you? Right? Your daughter is in school. Why is she picking her up? She's like, well, I was home. And I was like, well, if you're home, why didn't you pick up your own daughter? Why do you have your 12-year-old picking up your 8-year-old? So that probably wasn't the best thing. So it kind of, you know, elevated the mood and the fight, and then the threats came, and, you know, they threatened, the front desk threatened to call the police, and they end up leaving, and then, you know, I end up leaving, and one looking over my shoulder and wondering, were they going to jump out? And it was her and him, right? The mother and the father. Were they going to jump out and jump me? And just remember, you know, getting in my car, going home. I lived in Kensington at the time, and it was Bed-Stuy. Had a little Hyundai accent. And remembering waking up the next morning and wondering, am I going to go back? And then realizing that if I don't go back, right, then I'll never be able to go back, even if I go back. And then I'm telling the girls, one, they're not worth it, and two, that that when it gets hard, you stop. Even if I go back in a few days, because the whole decision was, do you let it die down? And, and that's what the why was trying to tell me, let it die down, and, you know, maybe cancel, you know, you don't want to put people's lives at risk, and they come back, and I'm feeling like I'm not the one putting people's lives at risk, like, they're putting people's lives at risk. And if you feel like there's a threat, close down the Y, you know, and feeling like there was a accountability, and that I wasn't going to back down. And while I wasn't going to provoke them, I also wasn't going to stop what, for many, was such an amazing outlet. And by that time, we had 80 girls coming. We had teams. We had schools. We had things set up. So not going disrupted all of that. And what other kid is going to be stranded there, you know? And that also understand I did nothing wrong. And that if they do jump out, if they do shoot me, if they do stab me, if they do jump me, you know, that I'm willing to go through whatever it takes to do this work. And just committing to that. Around that same time, an 8-year-old girl was raped on her way to school in the morning. And it was, again, just the reality that even within our own communities, like we have to recognize that, you know, the least valued are Black girls. Like even a puppy would have been valued more than her walking from the site of the rape to school and nobody stopping her at 8 years old in the morning, and nobody even seeing her abduction, and nobody even seeing her. Like we're invisible. And that you know, that we had to go deep and deeper and take those risks, not being a martyr, but take those risks that really meant something, or it meant nothing. It just was another program or activity, and I already had vowed to not do that at leaving, you know, the Brooklyn A's task force and leaving, you know, the system of assessment, reassessment every 6 months and bill for Medicaid and, you know, that system of really not feeling like we're having impact. And that just grounded me in, like, if you're going to do it with purpose, on purpose, like, and that's what you signed up for and applying for this fellowship, that's what it was, then do it. And so then that's when I applied for the 501c3 and was granted it in 2002, June, and, you know, realized that this was so needed. So many came, so many hands have touched this work and made it great, but that it was also lifelong, that I likely wouldn't see the change that I want to see within my lifetime in the way that I want to see it. And if that ultimately, you know, is reflective of being able to say, I don't see a Black woman president in my lifetime, like, that's what I'm saying. I think a Black woman president would happen, but not in my lifetime. And but how can I contribute to that, making the world just a little better while I'm here? And I don't think you have that. I think you all the way, or you do something else. You get out of the way. And so...
So how do you differentiate in your mind? You say, on the one hand you say, I'm not a martyr and I don't want to be a martyr.
No.
On the other hand you say, I'm willing to risk my life on behalf of this goal or organization. So when you talk to, if they had jumped you and killed you, people might have said she martyred herself for the organization. So in your head, what are the boundaries that you set for yourself that prevent you from being a martyr?
So in my head, I am fighting for my own life, right? So in my head, I'm still, or at least in my soul and doing this work, there's always a little girl inside of me that knows that it takes community and it takes intentional, like, I'm willing to do whatever it takes, you know, and not just anything. I think that that's the piece of martyrdom that I think about, it being like, I would never burn myself alive with the name of gender equity. It's just not, you know, gonna go to that extreme, but it's the reality that girls are dying every day. Girls are missing. We don't measure the disappeared. Girls are being sexually abused and trafficked, literally. We don't even know. Maybe in this building next door, there's a girl being held hostage. We don't know. And the reality that, you know, we don't have the luxury to wait, and we don't have the luxury to do nothing, right? That we have to keep creating conditions for girls and creating awareness and programming, as well as addressing policy, that this work needs to continue happening, and that because somebody threatens me. Like, I didn't, you know, then go provoke them, here, I'm waiting for you, and, you know, it's going to, let's duel it out to the death. I didn't want them to jump me. I didn't want to be jumped. I did file, you know, a police report against them. I didn't go pick it up, but, you know, but I got it on the record. I was told, get it on the record. I got it on the record. And it was the reality that they did come to jump me. I tried to talk my way out of it. And then I'll try to run. I also try to, you know, fight back. And that the decision was, though, I wasn't going to compromise my integrity. I wasn't going to compromise because I wouldn't want to be compromised on. And I know that, you know, that 8-year-old would have wanted somebody to not compromise. And so it was, it's more the reality, you know, that if I don't do it for myself, if I don't do it for my sisters, like, nobody will, right? And more that reality. And we feel it now, and I say feel it when I say we as Black women in this world right now feel it, who are connected to the Black Lives Matter movement, who are connected to what is happening internationally, bring back our girls, what is happening in Haiti. I mean, even 6 of the Charleston 9 were Black women, and it was in the name of white women that this terrorist killed them, right? And so, ain't I a woman? Like, we're still asking that. And so, if we're not, I feel like if I can't even do that for babies, right, 8 years old, young girls, then I'm saying I can't do it for myself, and I can't do it for other women. And I guess the, I just feel obligation to do it, and I feel a commitment to do it, and a desire to do it, and ability to do it, and I'm willing to do it, to the best of my ability. At the same time, it has come at a cost, right? So while it's not martyrdom, I have made decisions that have had me work way more than I ever imagined working, and have a work-life balance that's not quite balanced in the way that I imagined it being balanced, right? So going from a girl who played sports all year round, didn't need to get a job in high school, didn't need to get a job in college, maybe had work study, you know, play sports, had fun. I definitely know fun. But understanding that, like, this work and doing this work has really come at a cost of fun and life and health and, you know, creating that balance, and that I have to do better around that. And I also, and also the community has to do better around that. Mm-hmm. When I say community, nonprofit industrial complex, peers, our own community, there's still a lot of work to be done on many levels.
Do you, I know it's noon, do you need to stop?
I'm going to have to jump on this call.
Okay, all right. I may at some point, the one remaining thing that I wanted to ask you about is connected to that and the nonprofits and the sort of economics of it and the financial context in which you work. And so maybe there'll be some way for me to come back and ask you about that or talk to you later about it.
But okay,
it's connected to that, what you were just saying, and how we support this work and where the money comes from and how people live lives like this.
I have
right?
a lot to say about that,
yeah,
so we should pick that back up.
Okay, all right, we'll talk about that another time.
Okay.
All right, well, thank you
Rachel,
so much.
Rachel, thank you so much.